from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, typhoon devastation, an Obamacare walkback, Iran, immigration, and a 60 Minutes apology on Benghazi. The president out yesterday with an Obamacare reversal, making good for a while on his promise that if you like your care, you can keep it.
To those Americans, I hear you loud and clear. I said that I would do everything we can to fix this problem, and today I'm offering an idea that will help do it.
Republicans still looking for a full shutdown on the health reform. Here's House Speaker John Boehner.
Let's be clear. The only way to fully protect the American people is to scrap this law once and for all.
And a long tale of suffering in the Philippines a week after Super Typhoon Haiyan.
People of the world, come to my city. We need you. Please.
Come to my city. We need you. We need help. We need help very badly.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News, Benjamin Pauker of Foreign Policy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the president have to blink? Can he steady the boat here? Can you imagine life in the trail of the Philippines' big typhoon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Tolliff, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, watching the president and the healthcare saga very closely. Margaret Tolliff, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Benjamin Pauker, managing editor for Foreign Policy magazine. Plenty to talk about there as well. Benjamin, Ben Pauker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Benjamin.
Let's go straight to Obamacare and the president's reversal yesterday and what's brewing in response or beyond that response on Capitol Hill. Margaret, can you just walk us through what did the president do? Can he do that just on his own writ? And what's coming, being proposed at the same time out of Congress, Margaret?
So the first question was, did he have to blink? And the answer is yes, he totally had to blink, and so he did. So what he's doing here is an administrative, what he's trying to do is an administrative one-year reprieve to those Americans who heard him promise, if you like it, you can keep it, and then it turns out that they can't. So that's what he's trying to do, but in doing so, he's pushing this decision to the states, and how easily executable it actually is depends on the states and whether they feel like playing ball, and depends on the insurance companies and whether they feel like playing ball.
They don't have to. They don't have to extend these policies. They can cancel them. Of course, they always could. But now the whole realm has changed. Does it mean that what the administration then has been calling these what they call subpar, very inexpensive policies, if your insurance company says, fine, you can have it for another year, and that's all he's offering here, I guess, that will be the option for those who heard that promise, Margaret?
That's right. Well, that's sort of the goal. But some of these people may find out. And even though we're talking about a small percentage of Americans, there are a lot of Americans. So we're talking about probably like at least a million people, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe 5 million by some estimates. And this is all going to sort of shake out in a fairly short period of time, because mid-December is the time when was supposed to be the sort of cutoff time for the enrollment to start in January. And so these insurers and these states are going to be working real fast right now to figure out what to do. I mean, if I were one of these million people who had bought my policy on the individual market and thought I might be getting canceled, I would go on that troubled website, hope it got untroubled, and figure out what else was out there just in case, right? I mean, he's trying to come up with a resolution that minimizes how much Congress can unpack his law legislatively and pushes the fault to the states and the insurers. But in the end, he's still the guy who promised to take care of people.
You say he had to blink, Margaret. Why did he have to? I mean, I understand the politics here. A promise was heard. He's got his own, you know, Bill Clinton saying, oh, you better make good on that. But policy-wise, does this work for the health care reform that he fought for?
Well, two really important things happened this week, and one was precisely what you just said. It was President Clinton coming out in an interview and saying, hey, you're only as good as your word if you're the president, and he may need to change the law to fix this because he promised people. And the second thing that happened were those enrollment numbers. You'll remember they had been at one point saying they thought they'd get 800,000 people signed up within the first couple of months. And look at those figures, 106,000 signing up for private insurance and only a quarter of those through the federal marketplaces. So 27,000 people. You know, that's the grand total that they were able to sort of eke out, because of the problems with the launch of this website. Those numbers were terrible compared to what they were aiming for. And then you look at how many people signed up through Medicaid, 400,000 people already through expanded Medicaid, which cost taxpayers money. So this is fueling all of the arguments that the critics have been making about how this is going to jack up costs and how there are problems. And, you know, in the long run, once they get the website launched, and assuming that people who are healthy and young also sign up, these are all problems that would shake out. But in the short term, which is really important in politics, none of this has gone the way it was supposed to.
And then, of course, there's the pressure, and it's on right now from Capitol Hill. Here was the president first. This was yesterday. His press conference at the White House talked about the health care law's shortcomings and problems, and said there would be a one-year extension for those who wanted to keep plans that might otherwise have been canceled.
The bottom line is insurers can extend current plans that would otherwise be canceled into 2014, and Americans whose plans have been canceled can choose to re-enroll in the same kind of plan.
And he got into bigger issues, which a lot of people are looking at here, above all, maybe his own credibility.
I think it's legitimate for them to expect me to have to win back some credibility on this health care law in particular, and on a whole range of these issues in general.
A bunch of people want it to work, a bunch of others do not. Here was House Speaker John Boehner talking with reporters about the health care law, saying it's just not salvageable. That's the Republican line.
You can't fix this government-run health care plan called Obamacare. And this is going to destroy the best health care delivery system in the world.
But there were some kind of breakaway voices within the president's own party. Here's Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat, Louisiana. She's trying to thread maybe a middle path through all this. Here's Landrieu.
We're going to be working across the aisle not to repeal the Affordable Care Act, not to defund the Affordable Care Act, not to undermine the Affordable Care Act, not to gut the Affordable Care Act, but to fix it.
Jack Beatty, there's Senator Landrieu. She's feeling the heat, and she's saying, we don't want to repeal it or gut it. We want to fix it. What about the fixes that people are looking at on Capitol Hill, Jack?
Well, those would be drastic. The Upton plan, Fred Upton, a Republican from Michigan, his plan essentially would destabilize the whole of Obamacare. It would allow insurance companies to offer these substandard policies for everyone.
And forever.
And forever. Mm-hmm. Landrieu's is only slightly better because, of course, it would let the pressure off young people to sign up. It would be a signal, you don't have to do it now. Well, because, of course, your policy will be mandatorily renewed if it's one of these substandard policies under Landrieu. The trouble with that, of course, is if the young people don't sign up, the exchanges have to charge higher premiums to everybody else. And Landrieu would be swapping a crisis now for a crisis in October when the new rates come out and they're higher, and rate shock will confront her when she's running for re-election in Louisiana. So it's a very bad idea. The president's is the worst bad, but it's a bad idea. I mean, if it worked, it would follow the same logic as Landrieu's and destabilize the very thing that he needs, which is to keep these exchanges viable and to keep the prices down in them. You know, the president got into this mess because he didn't tell the truth. He didn't say 95% of you. All he had to do was say that.
Yep.
He said, well, I didn't realize. I thought they would all be grandfathered. No one on his staff could have told him that. He got into this through politics, and now he's trying to use politics to get out of it rather than simply saying to the people, look, here's the logic of this thing. We've got to get the young people signed up. I misspoke. I shouldn't have said that. And some people are going to be paying more under the new policies. But you know what, folks? They're going to get better benefits under that new policy. They're not going to lose their homes if they get real sick. They're plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't say that. He didn't take the high ground of policy, the low ground of politics. He may fail at both.
I mean, I have heard him say pretty much that, but this thing's still in play. Ben Pauker, give us a long view here. You've got foreign affairs under your belt. We've got plenty of that to look at. But long view, do you see Obamacare finding its feet here, slowly clicking in or unraveling?
I think it's a difficult road for the president right now. He's facing some opposition from within his own party. Democrats who feel pressure from their own constituent bases. It's going to be a tough road. And I think the first thing, most importantly, obviously, is to get that website back up and running, able to register and to. And he also has to. You know, the media has turned very much against this. We've run a piece recently about this enormous trend in the national media against Obamacare. It's 80% of shows that are now mentioning this, and that's a tough hurdle. So I think, you know, he needs to get the website running. He needs to get his party back in line, but it's not going to come fast.
Jackie's talking about his own credibility in a very wide-ranging way in the press conference yesterday, and I guess the numbers bear out the reason for that.
Oh, they certainly do. 52% now do not think he's trustworthy. That is just poison. Approval rating, 39%. That's where President Bush was after Katrina. And today's front page of the New York Times, the comparison is to Bush after Katrina. And, of course, the White House can say, well, I'm not running for re-election. No, but his party will be. And, you know, in 2006, when Bush was in this sort of situation, his party lost their majority in the House and the Senate. And that could happen to the Senate next year for the Democrats.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a big week in the news: typhoon devastation, an Obamacare reversal, a 60 Minutes apology on Benghazi, and more with Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News, Benjamin Pauker from Foreign Policy, Jack Beatty is here as well. What are you thinking this week on the Obamacare tensions and the president's reversal on You Can Keep Your Coverage? Beyond that, what's the lesson in the Philippines typhoon and the suffering and devastation and difficult relief effort there? Is the U.S. right to push hard for more Iran negotiation? Lots of back and forth over that this week. Is the alternative war? And is immigration reform dead? Again, can we just keep punting on that front? Let's bring in our listeners, Mary in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask why the media isn't asking the follow-up question, which is, how many people really do like their health insurance coverage?
You mean their current plan, you're saying?
Yes, I work in healthcare. I can tell you that there are legions of people employed who do nothing but argue with insurance companies over denied claims, not wanting to pay for needed services. How many people really do like their current insurance?
You know, it's a great question. And beyond those who are employed, I mean, those who aren't and have to get it on the private market, some may like that very low cost, but when it hits the fan, that can be tough. I mean, Margaret Tolliff, you know, Jack says, why haven't they put this message out more effectively? Is the message not been delivered over all this time effectively, Margaret? Is the media somehow more prone to look to the critical side? How do you look at the dynamics of how the American people are understanding this? And then, I mean, there are metrics. There's that sign up. It's not high.
That's right. Part of the reason why the sign-up isn't high is simply because people couldn't sign up. You know,
of course.
I mean, they just couldn't. And you know, Mary poses a really interesting question. I actually think there are, a lot of stories that are feature stories going to talk to people who are struggling with these decisions right now. But it depends on what coverage you're looking at. If you're looking at the coverage out of the White House or Congress that's framing, you know, the debate day to day, you know, that's. There are a lot of different stories and coverage and angles looking at this, but the stories by the people who are saying, here's what the president said and here's what Congress said, they're not doing those stories. But there are those other stories, and I think there are a lot of people who are finding that when they go on there, even if their policy is being canceled, they can find something else that maybe the structure is a little different. But there are people who just insist that they're fine with the policy they had and really feel betrayed by the president. I think the messaging question is different than the substantive question. The substantive question is, even if you can't get the same policy, can you basically get the same policy, or can you get something that you can live with?
Or
that
Mary
you like
says
a little better.
Better.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah. Or maybe it's better but more expensive, or maybe the deductible is higher, or maybe the premium is higher, you know. But that's different. The question that the president has forced now onto the table is, You said I could keep it and I can't keep it, so what else can't I keep, right? What else isn't true? What else is more complicated than you said it was going
to be? What about that issue? I mean, the White House, you're covering the White House. When the Bush Hurricane Katrina comparison comes up and the president's numbers, polling numbers on trustworthiness, which has always been a great strength of his, even with when people didn't agree with his policies, that number hung very high. Now it's not so high. Do you see the White House responding to that?
Yeah, like he's really upset about this. It's really bad, right? And I think the Katrina comparison is valid only in the sense that Bush was the most recent president and Obama ran against the Bush legacy. But, Katrina was different. Like, there was loss of life. There was, like, immediate catastrophe, right? And this is a lot more, I think, like the Read My Lips pledge. Because it's like
Bush Sr.
You know, Bush Sr. knew that you can't ever promise that you're not going to do something. And he promised it anyway. And Obama knew that he couldn't control what was going to happen with this. That it was entirely plausible that the same policies wouldn't be available. And he said it anyway. It was just like, let's just say it. And we have to say it to sell it. And we'll just deal with it later. The fallout's not going to be that big a deal. Nobody's going to care. I mean, it's essentially what he said.
Of course, Mary's trying to look at a bigger picture beyond that minority who are worried about their policies going away or may have been going away already. But those are center stage right now. Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, sir. It seems like the argument is shifting away from how can we fix, what's wrong with health care. And it obviously is over the past long period of time, things of health care is very challenging for a lot of people. And, it seems like the argument now is shifted to, there's something wrong with it rather than how can we fix it. And I just wondered, what the government can offer, what the Republicans, what can be offered, other than just saying it's going to kill the best health care system in the world and all the other rhetoric.
The rhetoric, yeah. Jim, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, I mean, we heard Tom Harkin today, senator out of Iowa, saying the president should not have stood down on this because we can't go back to what we've had, that it's not good. GOP, extremely critical. We heard John Boehner in that tape, Jack, saying we got to get rid of this. Do you see, is there an emerging Republican plan that they could offer to the nation and say, well, this would take us forward out of the troubled past now of our health care profile?
No. The last I looked into this, Paul Ryan was talking about coming forward with something in January. So they haven't. I mean, the only thing they have voted on that could be construed as a health care plan was the Ryan plan, which would have cut another, 13 million people off Medicaid. It would have been a sort of a policy disaster, leave out the moral issue, because, of course, those people would simply go to emergency rooms and everybody's premiums would rise, paying for that cost shift. So, no, they have not come forward with anything. Karl Rove had an idea the other day that the part of the deductibility of health care, insurance for employers, that some of that money could be used, somehow reprogrammed to take care of the uninsured. Who knows what that means? But no, they have not offered an alternative. And, just to get back to Mary's point about satisfaction with systems, Paul Krugman cites this study all the time. The people who are most satisfied with their health care are veterans. Why? Well, it's a public system. And they have publicly paid doctors. It's a fully socialized system. The second category of people who are most happy, they're not delirious about it, but they're more happy than not, are Medicare recipients. Private doctors, public funding. The third least happy people with private insurance.
We got one more call here. We've got a lot to look at today. Jim in Stuart, Florida. Jim, thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going there?
Okay.
I have one of those individual policies from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida that's getting canceled. So I'm actually looking forward to the continuation of the policy, primarily because the alternatives that they gave me, the three alternatives, were all more expensive and with crappier terms. So, prior to the announcement, I had gone to healthcare.gov, and first it was very hard to get a user ID and password. Then I tried a couple weeks later, and then the website itself was a bit flaky. And my next alternative was just to call the 800 number and see if I could get some insurance that way. But now with this this bit of news going on, I'll be happy to carry on with my existing policy.
Well, I mean, but Jim, the argument is that a very cheap policy is not likely to be as good as what you're going to get under the new health care reform. Are you sure about those terms, that your terms before were better?
Well, I'm not. I'm not. What I do like, though, is the fact that it's cheaper than the alternatives that Blue Cross was giving me.
Yeah.
You know, on the other hand, if I had, you know, seen a smorgasbord of other policies out there that were more attractive, then of course I would go with that. So what
it's kind of a ball of wax here. Hey, Jim, I want to take it right there, if I may. I appreciate your call. Now, listen to that, Jack. It's hard to use the website, so you can't see the whole smorgasbord. And so, understandably, he's got something
Absolutely.
He's okay with. And on the then he's got difficulty in figuring out the rest, and he's glad for this extension. I mean, here's my bottom line question on this one, Jack. Do you see Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, slowly finding its feet and clicking in here? Or do you see it? Are we watching it begin to unravel?
Well, I think there is another piece of unraveling coming up, and that the Washington Post warned this week that the administration's statements, we're going to have this fixed by the end of the month. People within the technical community say that's not going to happen. So already they're setting up a second credibility issue. And Todd Park, who's the IT advisor to the White House, in his testimony this week before the House, he wouldn't commit to that. He said, well, the vast majority of people will be, well, who knows what that really means. So they have that threshold. But beyond that, of course, if this starts to work, people will accept it. I mean, that's been the pattern of social insurance over the decades. And this week, Robert Reichauer, the former director of the CBO, said that, you know, if this is in place for 6 months, it'll be impossible to repeal or change it in ways that significantly reduce benefits, because then the Republicans will be saying to people who have benefits, we want to take those away from you. That neutralizes their other claim, which is that Obamacare is bad for you.
Of course, that's the fear. Right now, they're pushing really hard. And I would say if you're a Republican, you must feel at this moment like there may yet be a chance to unravel this. Some Democrats coming over, but if it clicks ahead and clicks ahead, we'll see. Big changes take time. They don't get forever. I want to turn to that unbelievable typhoon and aftermath in the Philippines. Here's just one woman in Tacloban yesterday at the airport, waiting with many there for any kind of relief, food, water, medicine to get out. Here she was talking with Euronews.
We haven't received anything, not even a drop of porridge. My two siblings could die. My older brother and my nephew are sick. I'm the only one who's not ill. Are they going to wait for all of us here to get sick and die one by one before they do anything?
Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, sharing that problem. The U.S. in there in a big way. Last night, Marine Corps Commander for Relief Operations there, General Paul Kennedy, talked with NBC News, says he thinks the U.S. military will get a handle on the relief effort. We're talking U.S. Here, and they've already made a huge difference, he said, in many areas, but it is very widespread. All those islands, so much damage.
We could always use more trucks. We could use generators and water purifiers, but we have those things. They're all been pushed down there. People that are in life-threatening situations, to them, their sense of urgency is great. We're trying to get to them as quickly as possible. But I think what your audience ought to understand is this is probably the most remote situation that you could imagine. It takes hours or days to get down to these islands from Manila.
3,000-plus dead now. And Ben Pauker, the fear has been that the relief, as much of it has piled in there, just wouldn't be able to get out to people in time to stave off another round of deaths. Does the news suggest that the relief is finally beginning to get out in an effective way across that huge area of need, Ben?
Well, there is a massive aid effort that's now underway. The USS George Washington, a big aircraft carrier, has arrived. There's 5,000 soldiers and 80 aircraft, and they are starting to deliver aid. There is a U.S. ship that's on its way from Sri Lanka currently with rice. But it isn't – the devastation of the storm is so extreme, and the power of it was so remarkable that – you know, that it's extraordinarily difficult reaching some of these remote locations. Communications are still down. You know, the death toll is still still rising. You know, it is at 3,000 in that range right now, but it's extremely difficult to reach some of these remote areas. You know, they are still collecting bodies. There is now a mass grave outside the city of Tacloban where they are starting to bury people. But 30 to 40% of the city is reportedly have now fled, leaving the devastation behind. So it's extremely difficult for aid agencies and NGOs and, you know, the UN cluster of agencies from the World Food Program to the, you know, refugees to actually reach these people. So it's, you know, and there are concerns about long-term sort of effects, you know, disease. But, you know, immediately people need water, people need food, people need electricity. And that's been very slow in coming.
Of course, that suffering and need for relief comes first. But there are geopolitics around this already. A lot of people looking at China. At one point, maybe even now, they'd contributed less than IKEA to the relief effort there. They've got their standoff in the South China Sea with the Philippines over islands. Is this ending up being a kind of China versus U.S., who's going to help most here, or a geopolitical story at the same time? It's a human tragedy, Ben.
I think this is a very, yeah, it's a very interesting story. There is really a contest for soft power in the Philippines and in that region writ large, whether it's Vietnam, whether it's Indonesia. There, China has been extremely strong in trying to delineate its control over the South China Sea. And if you can sort of imagine a map of the ocean south of China, they claim up to 1,000 miles away areas, you know, islands, areas of interest that are both geopolitical, shipping lanes, oil and gas.
This is right in the Philippines' face, not just the Philippines, but definitely the Philippines.
Exactly. I mean, there's Scarborough Shoal is the area that's of most interest. This is almost 1,000 miles from the Chinese coastline, and it's very close to the Philippines. And this has been an area of massive contention. You know, the Philippines has actually taken China to court under international maritime law.
Worth it to rich China, now rich, certainly at the top anyway, to be seen in these soft power contest terms as holding that against a population that's acutely suffering?
Well, I think that there was some miscalculation on the part of Chinese authorities, or so it seems. They initially only released $100,000 in humanitarian aid, which was widely criticized at being just a paltry sum. Later, they've now released $1.6 million, but it's still significantly less than the U.S., which has, you know, pledged $20 million. Japan has pledged $10 million. Japan has also sent 3 ships and 1,000 troops. They're sending C-130 airplanes in to aid with the humanitarian relief. But, you know, I think there is a calculation. There was an influential Chinese newspaper, the Global Times, which is, you know, seen as a mouthpiece of the Chinese government, which actually, in a very unique statement, criticized the paltry relief from China and said, look, this is not the time to be engaging in this dispute. Yes, there are issues, but this is something where the Chinese government really needs to aid the Philippine people.
Let's come in to with the William in Columbia, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a college student in Columbia, and I hear these cries for help from the Philippines.
Yeah.
But I'm so, you know, confused as what can I do to help, because I don't have, you know, many resources, but I want to help and I'm curious how to go about doing that.
I mean, listen, William, put in $5. If a lot of people do that, that turns into a lot of money. You don't have to be rich to help. You don't have to have a lot to help. And what I'm hearing everywhere is cash is the best way. We put up a list of places you can give that kind of help earlier this week on our website. Check it out, onpointradio.org. Jack, more widely, I mean, what strikes me here is devastation on a scale that human relief just has trouble addressing, particularly in these Pacific islands so vulnerable as seas rise. How do you prepare for a calamity on this scale? Maybe we can't, Jack.
No, the only way to do it is through policy, is through changing policy that you know, was putting carbon into the atmosphere. And that's why perhaps the greatest legacy, if he can get it through, of the Obama administration will be the EPA regulation of existing power plants. That could really be significant.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, an apology, not from the president. CBS 60 Minutes apologized for a critical report last fall on the Benghazi attack for airing eyewitness testimony from a man who wasn't there in the fraud hours he described. Now debunked, 60 Minutes' Laura Logan delivered the mea culpa.
It was a mistake to include him in our report. For that, we are very sorry. The most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth. And the truth is, we made a mistake.
A little while in coming, that. In New York, a tall, tall spire got the one World Trade Center declared the tallest building in America, beating out Chicago's Willis Tower, the old Sears Tower. New Yorker Lori Joe was happy for the win.
It kind of brings back some of the glory that we had from the Twin Towers, and it's kind of like a little healing balm, considering after all that happened.
And a number one high school college football recruit, Deshaun Hand of Woodbridge, Virginia, made his college pick in front of his family and the entire high school. Deshaun Hand is going to...
Well, it was a long process, but next year I will be attending the University of Alabama.
One ticket up and out. We're looking at a week in the news, typhoon devastation, an Obamacare reversal, a 60 Minutes apology on Benghazi, immigration reform, Iran. Let's go to Mary in Charlotte, North Carolina. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk a little bit about 60 Minutes and Laura Logan. It's interesting. I watched Newsroom on HBO this year, and in that story, the series on HBO, they had the same situation where a false story was floated and they aired it, and then they had to retract it. And in that, the last scene of the series this year, they decided not to fire anybody. And I lost total credibility, in this show. And this is exactly what's happening with 60 Minutes. And I love 60 Minutes and trust 60 Minutes, but Laura Logan should be fired. She had connections. Her husband was, connected with all this crazy stuff, and I think she should be fired so that 60 Minutes can, get their credibility back.
Mary, we've got it. Ben Packer, how about it? Hey, even Aaron Sorkin's newsroom isn't good enough, and 60 Minutes isn't cutting it for Mary. Can we go first, Ben, to the testimony of this man who said he was there, he was up on the wall, he hit the guy in the face with his rifle butt and all the rest. How critical was that 60 Minutes report, including this piece now withdrawn, to the controversy that blew up after Benghazi and the critique of the Obama administration's performance?
Well, I think it stoked the fires of, Lindsey Graham and a bunch of Republicans who still want to get to the bottom of the Benghazi incident. The Dylan Davies' testimony here to the FBI obviously conflicted with the report that he gave 60 Minutes, and they have admitted that they were duped by it, but it certainly has served to stoke the flames of conspiracy theorists and people who feel like the administration or the government still hasn't given a pretty clear report of what they knew and when they knew it. CBS is in the midst, and 60 Minutes is in the midst of a journalistic review. I think that they have clearly said that they were duped, that and they have apologized for it very publicly. We'll see what comes, whether people are fired.
But I'm still trying to figure out whether what they heard from this one man, and that's really what they're apologizing for, was this part of their report. I know it gave a head of steam to critique, but was what he said on 60 Minutes key to undermining some administration story about the events of that night or not?
Well, I think that, he had said that he was there. He said that this attack was premeditated, that it was planned. There was – in the 60 Minutes report, they erred towards the side of saying that this was a solely al-Qaeda attack. Everything the administration has said in multiple reports say that this was not solely al-Qaeda, that there were several rebel groups, main among them Ansar al-Sharia, which is a brigade in Benghazi. So I think that certainly this testimony did conflict with some of the administration reports. Absolutely.
Margaret Tolliver, does the administration feel it's got some redemption here? Lindsey Graham is saying, look, now you tell us, you let us understand that he wasn't actually there. Tell us the rest. Let us talk to everybody. How's the White House looking at this 60 Minutes withdrawal?
It redemption is probably a great word choice. It does certainly feel that way. On the other hand, it doesn't really feel like drawing back attention to the whole Benghazi thing.
No.
Like, they want to move on. They thought they wanted to move on to healthcare. Maybe not so much. But maybe they want to move on to highlighting how robust and fast U.S. response efforts to a typhoon can be. But they don't want to revisit Benghazi. But to the extent that they can say, look, every time you look for sort of the big conspiracy, it ends up being undermined by something like that isn't true. To that extent, yeah, I think they find some redemption in the story. But I think a lot of what CBS is going through right now in terms of its internal review suggests that we don't really know the full story. Look, this was in a book. The book was, they thought, vetted. And now they're calling, you know, for the publication to be suspended of the book. So this is a complicated story, and it's probably more complicated than Marion, North Carolina suggests. Yeah.
Jack?
Tom?
Yes.
Yeah, and the book is published by Threshold Books, which is a part of CBS. There's
right.
a conflict
yeah,
of interest right,
right
there. And the editor-in-chief of this publisher is Mary Madeline, who's, of course, a Republican consultant. It publishes Glenn Beck, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney. Now, the point is, you wouldn't all say, well, of course, these things are all wrong. No, but you would have a heightened level of scrutiny thinking, well, wait a minute, they would push the envelope in a, you know, right or conservative direction. Let's just check for that. They didn't. And one reason, I think, is Logan herself, and Mary gets at this just reading about her. Our friend Laura Washington, for example, the Sun column, sometimes columnist in
Chicago.
In Chicago, you reported that in a talk there, she called for retribution for these terrorist attacks. And I quote from Laura Washington, Logan hopes the America will, quote, exact revenge and let the world know that the U.S. will not be attacked again. This is not the way a dispassionate journalist talks. This is somebody who's a crusader. Probably it's a good cause, I suppose, if you want to prevent terrorism, but it's not the best mindset to be judging what should or should not pass.
On the other hand, this is someone who talks to the FBI, and like, it's not a huge leap to think, well, you probably wouldn't tell the FBI something that totally counters something you would put in a book. So I think... all of the stuff, you're right, is going to totally come into account during this internal review process and affects credibility and all of that stuff. But this is a really complicated story internally for CBS, I think.
I want to look on into that region and the issue over Iran and negotiations there. Senator Kerry this week on the hot seat on Capitol Hill with Republicans and Democrats. Not so sure they want to stick with his program, still calling for more sanctions, many there. Here's the Secretary of State yesterday on MSNBC's Morning Joe saying that ratcheting up sanctions would have bad consequences, including the possible road to military action with Iran.
Increasing the sanctions would be viewed by Iran as a bad faith step by the United States. It will encourage the hardliners in Iran, and then we're locked in to the next whatever number of years of a standoff, but a standoff in this circumstance, which becomes far more dangerous for Israel, our ally and friend, far more dangerous for the region, may even push other countries to nuclearize, and could result in the requirement that we have to, rather than have a negotiated, peaceful resolution of this, take military action in order to secure our goals.
Military action to secure goals, and most presuming that would mean war with Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, very critical of these negotiations, warning again and again it's a bad, bad deal. Now there's a delay. They resume next week. Al in Sterling, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Al. What do you think?
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
First, I'm 100% in support of Kerry and his program in negotiations. War with Iran is lunacy, just from a logistics standpoint. But more to my point, why do we care what Israel and France think? It's us. I mean, these people are largely lip service allies, and they're not going to do anything. It's up to the United States. We got the big stick. We're the decision makers. Forget about these people and go our path and do what we think is right.
You're not running for the Senate in 2014, are you?
and choose your district well. Ben Parker, how about it? Is there a divergence of interests here or just a difference in perspectives on what's going on? What about fundamental interests?
Well, certainly Israel sees this as an existential threat. Netanyahu is certainly not pleased with a general warming of relations from Iran to Washington. But, you know, this is a difficult negotiation for the Obama administration. It's certainly not popular. There's certainly a great deal of mistrust.
Not popular with who?
Well, it's not popular with a lot of people. I think with
there's a general
mistrust for Americans of Iranian intentions.
What about our caller right here who says he doesn't want war? He'd rather have negotiation.
Well, you know, polls have shown extraordinarily widely that no one wants war with Iran. The American people are fundamentally opposed to a new war in the Middle East and to an attack on Iran. That said, this is a difficult negotiation, and this is a sign of good faith that, you know, the administration wants to relax just a little bit sanctions on the regime in Tehran. Now, of course, that's extremely unpopular as well with Republicans, and both Kerry and Obama have had a lot of pushback on this.
Ben, you're not getting to my question, which is, are U.S. and Israeli interests here the same?
No, I think they're opposed. I think they both agree that there are certain red lines. There's some difference with regard to what those red lines are. I think Israel's are a little bit stronger, a little bit sort of more advanced. But the diplomatic solution both countries have said is the first step. Whether or not there needs to be a military response at some point, there is a difference of opinion there, certainly with Israel and Washington.
Samantha Power talking about all this today on CBS This Morning, saying it's a moment to test Iran.
We have to test this regime. I mean, there is so much mistrust, of course, that we bring to these negotiations after generations of suspicion, and that cuts both ways. With the temporary, modest, reversible, limited relief that we are promising here, in return, we freeze the program. They dilute some of the highly enriched uranium, and we get a much more aggressive inspection and verification regime.
Jack, what are you feeling here? These negotiations will go the distance, or you've got moves for tougher sanctions, which Kerry says will blow them up, and you've got Israel and more on Capitol Hill in this country who say this is not the path. Let's be tougher right now. Never mind.
Yes, I think it's lucky for the administration that the new meetings with Iran next week will come before Congress acts. And that may be a fortuitous timing for them. And I think today's news in the New York Times, that the IAEA has said that there are very few new advanced centrifuges installed since new president Rouhani took power. And people are saying, is that a sort of confidence building measure? Seems to me that's something that people who are trying to defend the administration in the Senate can point to. And beyond that, I do think the administration made an important step this week. It was made by Jay Carney in a press conference, and it was made by John Kerry in the statement you just quoted, and that is the alternative is war. The alternative is war. Because the president has eliminated, and this may be a very incautious move on his part, no deterrence. We're not going to have deterrence with a nuclear-armed Iran. We're going to prevent that. Well, of course, we've deterred nuclear powers for generations, but not with Iran. So if deterrence is off and containment is off the boards, it doesn't leave you much except a strike. And this is the alternative to it. This president was elected on the pledge to ease these sanctions. The prospect of that competing against the nuclear ambitions, and he's got a delicate domestic politics, and I think our people are right to say we need to show him something. We need to give him something that will allow him to deal with his hardliners.
A very active, fluid situation there. Be interesting to watch next week for sure. Let's bring it home to immigration. There was so much head of steam on this early this year, and both parties saying this may be the time. Democrats pushing that, Republicans after some election losses pushing that. This week, news conference, Washington on Wednesday, John Boehner said he will not consider a Senate-passed immigration bill.
We've made it clear that we're going to move on a common-sense, step-by-step approach in terms of how we deal with immigration. The idea that we're going to take up a 1,300-page bill that no one had ever read, which is what the Senate did, is not going to happen in that.
Not going to happen, says John Boehner. Nancy Pelosi here responding in her weekly press briefing. Minority leader in the House criticizing that and saying that Boehner's just not acting where action's necessary.
The very idea that there wouldn't be an immigration bill, I think that that's outrageous. I don't know why there isn't more of a... I don't know whether people are taking it seriously or not, but if that's the indication... Well, that's just a dereliction of duty in terms of what our responsibilities are here.
Pelosi says dereliction of duty. Margaret Tolliver, when John Boehner says step-by-step approach, is this the let's break it into pieces and do it in smaller chunks idea that we've heard? Does that have a chance of working, of flying?
It's a few different things. Part of it is the let's get past the Republican primaries of 2014 before we talk about its strategy. Part of it is the John Boehner, how long do I want to be House Speaker and what am I willing to risk for its strategy? Part of it is 2016 calculation strategy. Part of it is sequester strategy. Part of it is CR, a debt limit strategy. This is all wrapped up in all of that.
Wait, how does sequester come in here?
Look, starting basically now, right, in the middle of this ACA stuff, these budget negotiations got to restart. Then there is another budget funding timetable that we're looking at that rolls out between January and February in the middle of the State of the Union address, in the middle of the next budget talks, in the middle of how our defense budget's going to be protected. Why would the Republicans give away anything on immigration when all of that is in play and when they haven't figured out their own internal strategy for how to do this?
You mean even that would be brought into a grand bargain? Is that what you mean? Somehow it's all part of one great big poker game.
Everything's part of one great poker. It doesn't matter whether it's in the same bill or not, whether it's in the same negotiation. It is so hard to get anything done in Congress that something like this that has been backed up since the Bush administration is no one's gonna, it's not going to get wrapped up in a bow before December. Nobody thought that was going to happen. And this is really rhetoric on the part of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Nothing is going to happen like between Thanksgiving and Christmas with the middle of all this other stuff with so many implications for 2014 and 2016. It was never going to happen.
Wow, Jack, so much that could be done in the world here and so few things that look like they're actually going to be done. Nothing tied up in a red bow here. I guess that is the one true statement, Jack.
Not for this holiday season, that's for sure.
Well, thanks to all three of you for being with us today. Benjamin Pauker at Foreign Policy, thanks very much for joining us today, Ben.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Margaret Tolev, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thank you, Margaret. Great to have you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR, on Twitter. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rose, and Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.